At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Howdy, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Great to be with you. As always, you can live stream us on the internet. LarryKudlowShow.com. Is that still right? Yeah. LarryKudlowShow.com. Producers say that's still right. You can hear us throughout the country, around the world, throughout the solar system and the Milky Way. If you know what the Milky Way is, you can write us in because I haven't figured that out yet. But we do, actually, a lot of people hear us on the internet. We get a lot of live streaming. So it's good for us. And lots to talk about, as always. I want to begin, look, we're going to talk about the jobs number. We're going to talk about the crack up in the stock market. Why Jay Powell's not getting it done on inflation. Joe Biden, what am I reading? Joe Biden's in Ohio yesterday. This guy, God bless him. He's the only president we have, right? So he's reminiscing about the days where he could have lunch with segregationists in the Senate. What a wonderful idea that is. You got the audio? Let's play this. Play this nutty thing.
Even back in the old days when we had real segregationists like Eastland and Thurman and all those guys. But at least we end up eating lunch together.
Really? Diego, Cracker Jack producer. Thank you, buddy. So I'm just, you know, look, yeah, those were the days, but they weren't the great days. I mean, those guys wouldn't have lunch with, you know, with blacks, browns. I don't think they'd have lunch with women. The odd thing about it is Biden saying this, and he's calling conservatives, Trump people, MAGA people, the most extreme people in the world. And he then just launches in some reminiscence about having lunch with segregationists who hate blacks. Really? I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. But I want to go back to Roe v. Wade. I want to revisit some of the issues here. I mean, look, I put my cards on the table. If you watch us during the week on Fox Business, the name of the show is Kudlow. You'll know I've been talking all week long since that news broke Monday night. I am a strong pro-lifer, protecting the life of the unborn, have been for many, many decades. I also think the draft of Judge Alito, which would push the Roe v. Wade decision out and would give individual voters in the states and the state legislatures the right to make a determination state by state. I've long thought that that kind of states' rights approach, voter determination approach, was exactly right. Unelected judges shouldn't be making these key decisions. I want to add, you go back to Roe v. Wade, 1973, more than 63 million children were killed. Can you imagine that? 63 million children were killed by abortions. Now, I will say this, too. I offer this with all great respect to those people who maybe listen who do not agree with me. I appreciate that. I also don't dismiss. Look, I understand women who, for health reasons, want to have an abortion, the idea of women's choice, a right to choose. I understand that, but I always add to that conversation that who defends the unborn child and their right to live? I mean, that's always been the issue to me. This is God's creation. I mean, you get a heartbeat, I don't know, inside 6 weeks nowadays. And with all the science and technology, you know that there is a living child in the womb. I mean, most countries around the world, in fact, we looked at this on the Kudlow Show on Fox Business. We looked at this throughout Europe, I think something like all but two European countries restrict abortions to the first trimester, which essentially is what this Mississippi Dodd case is all about, Dobbs case, it's all about first semester. I mean, whether it's 12 weeks or 13 weeks or 14 weeks, that's pretty much the limit. Late-term abortion, to me, is a hideous thing, an absolute hideous, hideous thing. We played the debate, the last debate in 2016 between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, where they argued over this, and she defended late-term abortion, so-called partial birth abortion, and then-candidate Trump said no. He completely opposed to it, and he said he would appoint judges to the Supreme Court who were opposed to it. He made good on his promise to this day. I mean, I just support that completely. I think Donald Trump was the most significant pro-life president we've ever had. I mean, my friend George W. Bush was a pro-life president also and appointed conservative judges, but I just put my cards on the table so you know where I'm coming from. I'm just a strong supporter of the unborn. That's all. And I'm not a sociologist. I haven't really looked inside the numbers, but of those 63 million, some odd million people, children, who lost their lives to abortion, I'm going to guess, and I think it's an educated guess, that the biggest share of that were minorities, African Americans particularly. I'm going to guess, and if I'm wrong, I apologize. We're going to try to look into that as the show goes on. One of the managers here mentioned that to me, but I think that's probably a true fact. Maybe we can scare up some numbers on that. But the blacks are the ones who get hurt the most. That's my impression. But what is outrageous about this story as it unfolds is one thing, the failure of the Biden administration, as expressed by Madam Psaki, the soon-to-be departing press secretary. She's going to MSNBC. That's perfect. But from the president on down, there's no outrage. There's no condemnation of the leak, which is so corrupting and damaging to the reputation, the institutional reputation and regard for the Supreme Court, which is still one of our most respected institutions. I believe the military and the Supreme Court are right up there in the top several most respected institutions in American life at a time when, as most folks know, there isn't a lot of respect for anything in Washington, D.C., which is probably deserved. Trump called it the swamp. I worked in the swamp twice, once for Reagan, once for Trump. Not good. But point is, here we have no condemnation of the leak itself. And to me, that's just absolutely extraordinary. Now, Chief Justice John Roberts, whom I know, by the way, I mean, I'm not in his inner circle, but I knew John. We both worked for Reagan a long, long time ago. He was very kind to me when I first went to Washington in the Trump years. He came up and spoke to me at a dinner. Anyway, he called Trump, Chief Justice John Roberts called the leak of Justice Samuel Alito's opinion absolutely appalling. He's right. And then he said, if the person behind that leak thinks it's going to affect the jurist's work, then that's just foolish. Good for John Roberts. Strong statement. I saw in the paper this morning, Clarence Thomas said the same thing. It's not going to change anybody's mind. So if some liberal left twit, to use Ted Cruz's, Senator Cruz's phrase, thinks that this was a clever idea, guess again. It will not change their mind. Now, these drafts can go through iterations, wording can change, and I suppose intellectually a justice can change his or her mind along the way. I mean, I believe the draft first was written back in February. I don't know why they chose to leak it all of a sudden in early May. I guess the decision will come out in June or sometime in the early part of the summer. But it's not going to work. And it probably will stiffen the backs of conservative jurors who have signed on to the Alito draft opinion. But again, it is appalling that from Psaki, I mean, Biden, no one has, none of this, they don't care about this. All they care about is Roe v. Wade. They have no interest in preserving the Supreme Court and its reputation. I mean, just imagine if President Trump or some senior officials in our administration had leaked a big, important, controversial memo on almost any subject. I mean, the lefties would have gone crazy. If we had leaked something that, you know, might have impacted a big issue of the day, a big political, they'd have gone nuts. They want to impeach him. You know, well, they did try to impeach him. Of course, the leaks are on the other side. The leaks were at Trump, not by Trump. But you get what I'm saying, whether it's phony Russian collusion or GPS or any of these other silly things. And then one more thing I want to say before the break. And we're going to talk about this. Andrew McCarthy, former prosecutor, great friend, National Review contributor, Fox contributor. This crazy group, Ruth Sent Us, which has published the home addresses of the justices who signed on to the Alito draft memo. Amy Coney Barrett, of course, Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch. I mean, this group, first of all, the irony is they're talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was one of the earliest people before she was a justice who questioned the correctness, the viability of Roe v. Wade. She said it was a lousy decision, lacked constitutional weight. And boy, she was right. And she said, by the way, it's not going to settle the law. She and Scalise, they both said that this will not settle the issue. That's an important point that's gotten lost here. But anyway, they call themselves Ruth Sent Us, and of course, this is going to lead to violence. If they go and march on the homes, it will not be peaceful, which is what Psaki is saying. Oh, it's okay because there's a lot of passion and it will be peaceful demonstrations. No, it won't. Go back two summers ago when Black Lives Matter allegedly had peaceful demonstrations about that judge. I think he was a judge in St. Louis during those race riots, which turned violent. People attacked his house. And, of course, it happened in all the cities, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, New York, you name it. These BLM, you know, they're not peaceful. Antifa, they're not peaceful. They may label themselves peaceful. People on the far left who want to defund the police, they want to defund the Supreme Court. They want to attack the court. They want to try to intimidate the court. You can't do that. And it is just astonishing. Joe Biden should be ashamed of himself for not giving the justices major new additional protection. He should be ashamed of himself for not taking this seriously. He should be ashamed of himself for not. He has yet to condemn the leak. He has yet to say anything. This is just far left craziness. And no one's going to stand for it. No one's going to stand for it. 63 million abortions later. We have to worry about the health of the child, the life of the child. We got to worry about the life of these Supreme Court justices. We have to worry about the lives of anybody who protests in this country. We want peaceful demonstrations. It is up to the president to set the tone, the moral tone, and to enforce the laws. And by the way, it turns out, I think I read something yesterday, that anybody who demonstrates against a judge, a federal judge, I think this is right, is breaking the law. So there is nothing law-abiding and peaceful about this. All right, I got to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk some more about this. I want to get to the jobs issue. later on, and it's a mixed bag. The stock market, of course, down six straight weeks in a row. We still have a big inflation problem. Jay Powell, the Fed chairman, I don't think he should be confirmed. He's done a terrible job as Fed chairman. Anyway, we'll take a break. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Please stick around.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great pleasure to be with you. I just want to repeat here in the intro, where is the left's outrage over the Supreme Court leak and the threat to the individual justices? And again, Madam Psaki refuses to condemn the leak of the Supreme Court draft opinion. I'm just reading. This is from the Washington Times headline. I've been covering this on the Fox Business Show every night this week. By the way, it's 4 to 5 p.m. I should say this, 4 to 5 p.m. every night. And if you can't pick us up at 4, you can get your favorite 9-year-old who will show you how to DVR the show. 9-year-olds are much better at that than us older folk of a certain age. But really, this is such a serious issue. I mean, how can they not be? Joe Biden should have been out there. Instead of being in Ohio and reminiscing how wonderful it was to have lunch in the Senate 40 years ago with racist, segregationist U.S. senators, which is what he was reminiscing about, which to me is insane. I mean, they purport to be, you know, all about equity and justice in the Biden administration. Here he is talking about James Eastland. But whatever. Instead of that, he should be protecting his own Supreme Court justices. Not stacking the court. By the way, you know, Schumer and Pelosi think they're going to have votes that are going to pass legislation to codify Roe v. Wade. They're not, because they're not going to get through the filibuster, because the Democratic Party, at least the Democratic Party in the Senate's not going to let it happen. Manchin, Sinema, but there's several others. They will not permit that. But the point is, it is our Supreme Court. It's the United States Supreme Court. It is as much Biden's Supreme Court as any other president. And by law, they must be protected. And again, I see some headlines on TV this morning. Justice Thomas, Clarence Thomas, is saying, we will not be bullied. Good for him. That's basically what Chief Justice John Roberts said yesterday in a speech, I believe, down in Atlanta, Georgia, someplace down in Georgia. But this group, about whatever they call themselves, what's the name they call themselves? Crazy group. Ruth sent us. Ruth Bader Ginsburg sent us. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was, first of all, thought Roe v. Wade decision was a lousy decision. But this will lead to violence, just like Black Lives Matter and Antifa led to violence in all the cities 2 summers ago and last summer. And the Bidens always look the other way. You know, they criticize Trump and MAGA followers for being extremists. Bidens look the other way. They want to defund the police. Then they deny they want to defund the police. Here, I'll just say, look, it looks to me the failure to provide extra security. I mean, a lot of extra security. It's like defunding the court, okay? Why aren't you defending the Supreme Court? There'll come a time when Democrats can put somebody else on the Supreme Court, right? They just got this woman through, Jackson, I believe her name was. Defend all these justices, not on the basis of the cases that you like or don't like, but on the basis that they are justices of the Supreme Court. And by law, federal judges are protected. And Biden and his people should be ashamed of themselves for not doing this. We'll talk some more. We have Congressman Steve Scalise. He is the House Republican Whip, number 2 man. We'll talk some more about this in just a few moments, along with the jobs report and the inflation problem. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great pleasure to be with you, and very, very great pleasure to welcome back to the show Congressman Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana. He's the House GOP whip. He will. What happens, Steve Scalise, when the cavalry comes and you take over? What does you become the majority leader? How does that work?
Well, good to be with you, Larry. And
absolutely.
You know, we'll worry about all those titles later. But yeah, Brendan retired the title whip. It's been a lot of fun. But there's bigger things that we need to focus on next year. And I think you're going to see a lot of people coming out across the country, and not just Republicans. I mean, independents, and there's a lot of Democrats that are done with all this big government socialism. And so you're going to see a red wave with candidates that I think are going to be really exciting people that you're going to want to support all across the country.
Well, the tide is turning, and I just again want to thank you for giving all of us your time this morning on radio. You know, Steve, I want to go back. I'm obliged to go back to the Roe v. Wade issue. As I've said on the show, I'm a pro-life guy. I protect the life of the unborn. But here's the thing. What is infuriating me more and more is how Madam Psaki keeps saying, and there hasn't been a single disagreement from Biden that I know of, there is no outrage over the leak. There are no extra protections for the justices. This group has now published the addresses of the justices, inviting what I think is not going to be a peaceful demonstration, but will be a violent demonstration, just like they were last summer and the summer before. I mean, where's Biden's in Ohio, Steve Scalise, talking about reminiscing how wonderful it was to have lunch with segregationist senators 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But where's his protection for our Supreme Court justices right now? That's part that's bothering me enormously.
Yeah, Larry, it bothers me too. And frankly, you know, there should have been immediate repudiation of the leak. You know, what was interesting is within maybe an hour of the leak, you saw Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer not repudiating the leak, but going after the court on what could be this ruling. Mm. And again, the ruling's not out. It's not like it's definitive yet, but it's almost like they maybe had an advance notice of it or something. It's odd.
Oh.
I mean, they didn't repudiate the leak. And look, you've had Chuck Schumer making very public comments a while back, mentioning Gorsuch and Kavanaugh by name, saying, you know, it was very inflammatory language. And I wish the president would have said, look, the leak shouldn't have happened. It's unprecedented. It never happened before. But also encourage protection for these justices as well. And frankly, this is where John Roberts needs to take control of the situation, not just investigating the leak, which needs to happen. They need to release the ruling. Mm. And why not? I mean, this has been floating around for months now, according to all of the reports, and you know, don't put anybody at risk. Let's get that out there. But it shows you how radical the other side is. That you know, they're already calling for abortion on demand, paid for by taxpayers. When you contrast what this ruling would do, the ruling would allow elected leaders to make decisions on abortion policy, both at the state level and at the federal level, where it would be debated in public again, like it used to be before Roe v. Wade. And I think, number one, the science has advanced dramatically since Roe v. Wade. You didn't have the ability for ultrasound to see a baby in the womb, for example, back in during the Roe v. Wade ruling. Today, you have so much more science and knowledge. And you have states that are already have laws on the books, like New York, where a baby can be killed alive after it's born alive outside the womb. Mm. They can still kill the baby and call it abortion. That's murder. In most states, in New York, it's legal. And that's the position before and after this ruling is released. And so people, I think, are going to see that it's going to just open up a new debate with a lot more knowledge and science that wasn't available pre-Roe to protect life.
You know, we took a look at it on the Fox Business Show, Steve Scalise. Actually, you go throughout Europe. This is interesting to me. Something like, I don't know, 37 out of 39 European countries, the way they regulated abortions to the first trimester, after the first trimester, in nearly all cases, Europe would not permit an abortion. I mean, the idea of a third trimester, as you say, late term, that's just off the chart. The only people that do that are like North Korea and China. They are the only people that allow third trimester abortions or so-called partial birth abortions.
Yeah, it's an important point, Larry, because the extreme position in the world is America's position. If you look at the pro-abortion laws here, less than a handful of countries in the world have as extreme of a pro-abortion position in law as us. And, you know, the Democrats think that this is something that's going to be a political issue that they can win on. They're misrepresenting and misreading the polling. Most Americans want more limits on abortion. And I'll tell you, and I've seen this, the idea that you can kill a baby alive outside the womb, people that are pro-choice think that's barbaric and murderous. And yet it's legal in states like New York. So, you know, this is going to be, I think, an additional focus for people to know that, you know, let's go have this debate and but let's get this ruling out and go find whoever did the leaking. And, you know, if they're an attorney, a law clerk, they should be disbarred for life.
And I just would like to see President Biden just come out and provide extraordinary protection. What's so hard about that? Whether it's Secret Service. Now, there was some talk about federal marshals, but I haven't seen anything specific. Maybe you know something. I mean, I don't know that it has to be the National Guard. Maybe it does. I'm just saying, not only are they not speaking about the corruption of the leak, but they are not speaking about any help to protect the justices during this time, after this group released their home addresses. I mean, I just find this, Steve Scalise, incredible. I mean, they're always blaming Trump and MAGA and all the we're the all extreme crazy people. Well, how about the crazy people on the left? How about this whole story on the left?
No, and it's clear that he will not stand up. President Biden will not stand up to the most radical elements of their party. It's been the case all along. I mean, day one, the executive orders he signed to undermine our economy and our border security were all rooted in appealing to the most radical elements. And it just keeps going on. And, you know, and again, to not have the understanding that just it gives the moral equivalency of speaking out against the leak and for the safety of the Supreme Court justices, regardless of the outcome of the decision. And this was clearly an attempt to try to change a decision that's being made by the United States Supreme Court. And I remember when he was a candidate, he said, you know, I'm going to represent all people in America, whether they voted for me or not. Where's that Joe Biden?
Yep.
You know, and those are the things I think people are disappointed in and they're looking for in days like today.
Just one more thing on this, Steve Scalise. We did a little bit of homework here, one of the producers. Disproportionately, the leading consumer of the abortionist services is the African-American female. Listen to these numbers. According to the 2011 Abortion Surveillance Report issued by the Center for Disease Control, Black women make up 14% of the childbearing population, yet obtained 36.2% of reported abortions. Black women have the highest abortion ratio in the country, with 474 abortions per 1,000 live births. Percentages at these levels illustrate that more than 19 million black babies have been aborted since 1973. It is the blacks who get disproportionately hurt by these unrestricted abortion policies. This, too, from a Democratic Party that claims to speak for African Americans and defend their interests and so forth. It's almost like the crime in the cities, Steve Scalise. It is the blacks who are disproportionately hurt by the lack of police support and police funding. It's the blacks who get disproportionately hurt on this abortion issue. Same story.
No, so true. It's so true. And, you know, and again, I think you're going to see a heightened debate about the value of life. And, you know, you saw it with the defund police movement and quickly people in all communities, but especially those hardest hit by crimes, stood up against defunding the police because they realized that it's going to hurt them the most. And I think with abortion, you know, you're going to see an increased debate in the country. And this debate's been going on, but, you know, you go to the March for Life, for example, one of the most peaceful protests you could ever see, and an overwhelming number of people is the March for Life every year, usually in, you know, like January or like February, where you have hundreds of thousands of young people come to Washington to promote life and to stand up for life. And, you know, we talked about it at the last March for Life that, you know, let's pray this is the last March for Life that happens while Roe v. Wade is still law. And there's been a lot of praying and a lot of peaceful marching, but it's young people primarily that participate in that. So I think you're seeing a whole new generation where the first picture they saw themselves was not maybe a couple of hours outside their mother's womb, but it was through an ultrasound picture in their mother's womb. And again, that science didn't exist pre-Roe. And so I think you're seeing more and more people recognize the value of life and why it's important to have this debate and to win this battle.
We're talking to Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana. He is the number two Republican in the House. Steve, can we take a quick break and bring you back and talk about why inflation and the economy is really going to be a bigger issue than Roe v. Wade, Democrats notwithstanding? We'll just be a few minutes, I promise. We're very grateful to have you. Folks, I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back with Mr. Steve Scalise after this brief word.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're talking with Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana. He is the House Republican whip. Steve, we got a jobs report yesterday. It was an okay report. A little under 400,000 jobs with some down revisions. But I want to focus on average hourly earnings, in other words, the wage number. For the last 12 months, wages have increased 5.5%. Unfortunately, the consumer price index is up 8.5%. So real wages are falling. And actually, Steve Scalise, if I just focus on non-supervisory production workers, the salt of the earth, the hard hats, the blue collars, their wages are up 6.4%, which is a good, healthy number. But unfortunately, it's 2 percentage points less than the inflation rate. So real wages are falling, and I see this. I don't know. Democrats may think the revolt against Roe v. Wade is going to carry them to victory in November. I doubt it. What do you think?
Well, clearly, inflation continues to be the driving concern because it's hitting every single family, but it hits low-income families the most. As you point out, even if you see some increases in wages, it's well overshadowed by the increase in inflation. You're paying a lot more for everything. You go to the grocery store, it's 20% higher or more. If you go to the gas station, that's the most, probably the most obvious example of where President Biden's policies are really hurting low and middle income families. It's at the gas pump because he shut down American energy production. We still need energy, but we're being forced to get it from cartels and thugs like Putin, and it costs a lot more, 50%, 75% more to fill your car. And so these are the things that people are the most angry about. You know, the border crisis that was created by Joe Biden is another big factor you see all across the country. It's not just border states. You know, look, the fentanyl coming across, made in China, brought across our southern border because Joe Biden opened it up. We had more deaths last year amongst young people by fentanyl overdoses. Over 100,000 of our young people were killed last year. And it's because Joe Biden opened the border. And he won't do anything about it. This is what's angering people all across the country. And so these are all issues that are going to be, I think, the most important things people are talking about and voting on November 8th.
You know, it's a factoid. Roughly 75% of the goods transported inside the United States is transported by trucks, truckers. Three quarters, truckers. So we have record high diesel fuel prices. Diesel fuel, which is what they live on, could be $800,000 to fill up your truck. And there's a revolt going on amongst truckers. But this is one of the, again, Steve Scalise, this is one of the byproducts of the jihad against fossil fuels. Diesel fuel prices skyrocketing, and the truckers aren't going to deliver the goods, and then everyone's going to whine that the shelves are empty and blame something called supply chains. It's not that complicated. Why not just get more oil and gas production, bring diesel prices and gasoline prices down, and help the truckers for a change?
Yeah, Larry, and look, the voters get this. They see the president trying to blame it on Putin. And of course, gas prices were dramatically higher, over 40% higher before Putin even invaded Ukraine. In fact, because Biden shut down American energy, we were forced to buy oil from Russia. Putin was making $700 million a day pre-invasion of Ukraine $700 million a day Putin was pocketing by selling his oil to America and Europe instead of America producing our own oil, which is what we were doing under President Trump, and exporting it to our friends around the world. And so we don't have to reinvent the wheel to get back to those days. And people get this. They see this. You know, it's not the oil companies. Biden, again, after Putin's thing didn't work, he goes and blames the oil companies. He tried to call Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. They wouldn't even take his phone call. How embarrassing was that? But the bottom line is, you don't need to beg any dictator. You don't need to beg an OPEC cartel to produce America's energy, because we can produce our own energy. And if you're hiding behind this idea that man's destroying the planet and you don't want to use American oil because of fossil fuels, do you know it emits more carbon to buy energy from foreign countries, because we actually do it better? Because these folks that are attacking American energy, it's not just American energy. Just fill in the blank. They're attacking America. What's great about America? And so we do it better than anywhere in the world. Name a country that produces energy back. Name a country that produces anything better than us. But by putting all of these unrealistic caps in place, Paris Accords, it just kills America's economy and benefits China's. China's building a new coal plant every single week to make up the difference in manufacturing that we don't do in America much cleaner. We emit five times less carbon to make the same steel they make in China, but Biden's policies are making it harder to make things in America, not just energy, all kind of things, and it costs families more, and people get that.
You know, former Energy Secretary Rick Perry, a good friend of yours, good friend of mine,
yeah,
former Texas governor, of course. So, you know, Rick makes the case, all these wonderful greenies and these little Green New Dealers in the Biden administration. So imagine if they took down the restrictions on oil and gas production and drilling and pipelining, which is so important, and we sent massive volumes of LNG exports to China. All right, China, and I'll put in India too. Now imagine that. What that would do, to your point, is that would reduce Chinese coal, that would substitute American liquefied natural gas, which would slash carbon emissions for the globe, because China's the worst. Now, if you're a card carrying Green New Deal greenie in the Biden administration, I would want that. I would want to reduce carbon emissions by sending LNG to China. But that's not what they want. They want to end all of it and stop the permitting for pipelines and fracking and you name it. I just can't think of anything dumber, honest to God.
It's the most anti-environment policy if you look at this. Again, it all ends up in the same place, Larry. If you burn coal in China or you burn natural gas in America, whatever carbon is emitted ends up in the same place. But with the coal, it emits actually more carbon. So why would you want to make more things in China? Why would you want to shut down the whole American economy by going to the Green New Deal, where you won't be able to manufacture things here? Everything will cost you more money, but you'll actually be increasing global emissions. And they will not refuse. They hate to refuse it. When people like you, Donald Trump was in the White House, you and Secretary Perry and all of these folks that really understand energy policy, when y'all were in the White House, we were reducing carbon emissions in America more than anybody else. You know, Europe's not even – go to France. France is not even in compliance with the Paris Accords.
Right.
And yet they want to get us in all of these ridiculous, unrealistic, targeted policies that only hurt America and Europe's economy, and they benefit China. China and India, they're emitting more carbon. They're getting more jobs. Go look at Europe's economy. You know, Boris Yeltsin had people marching in the streets because of high energy prices in Europe, and then we're trying to go to that? Why would we want a European high-cost anti-production policy, again, when you emit less carbon by making it in America? Name me the country that does it better. To all these people that hate America across the board, whether it's teaching CRT in the classroom or trying to push the Green New Deal, what country does it better? Just name the country that does it better than America. Because you know what, Larry? You know this. Nobody does. So stop beating up America. We should be doing more things in America if you want to save the planet.
By the way, you have one of the best experts, your policy man, Francis Brooke.
Francis.
Who worked on the NEC. He's the smartest guy. He's also fabulous. Was a great college baseball pitcher. And threw batting. I think he was throwing batting practice the day that you got shot at.
He was.
I think he was. It's such a horrible story from which you have totally recovered, which is such a God-given miracle, by the way.
Miracle. God performs miracles.
Honestly,
but Francis is one of those Renaissance guys. You know, he does it all. He's great on policy. He's great on my team. We took all that knowledge and advice you gave him when he was working with you in the White House, and we're putting it to use to help us go get the House back and then start working to save this country.
I have one last question, Steve Scalise. Do you think it's possible that we could not have a $350 billion spending bill, the so-called Compete with China bill, which is nothing but a Green New Deal, corporate welfare, industrial policy, bailout bill? Could we not spend an extra $350 billion with an 8.5% inflation rate? Is that possible?
I'm sure hopeful that we don't. And, you know, look, all of these massive new spending bills that Joe Biden has done already have driven inflation to a point where people can't afford to pay for the daily things that they do. They're making those decisions. Do I buy my food for the family or fill up the car to go to work or buy medicine? You know, stop this spending. Get back to the basic fundamentals that make this country great. Stop beating up on what is great about America and go after the bad guys. You know, there's a lot of bad guys out there. There's bad guys in communities. They want to defund cops and not go after the bad guys. They want to defund America by taking away our ability to actually make things in America. And all that does is benefits the bad actors around the world. Let's stop doing that.
All
I
right.
think people get that.
Mr. Steve Scalise of Louisiana, thank you, sir. It's a great, great message. The cavalry is coming. We thank you for your time. Folks, I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk to former prosecutor Andrew McCarthy some more about protecting the Supreme Court justices. And then Steve Forbes of Forbes Media is going to come back later on, too. We'll talk about the jobs report and the inflation story. I'm Larry Kudlow. Please stick around. Lots more to do.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. By the way, you can live stream us on the internet, LarryKudlowShow.com, all across the country, throughout the world, and the solar system as well. We welcome to the show Andrew McCarthy, former district U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, contributing editor, National Review. I think he's a Fox News contributor as well, I'm pretty sure. And his most recent book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy McCarthy, welcome back.
Larry, great to be with you. Happy Saturday.
And you too. By the way, thank you for coming on the Fox Business Show, Kudlow. And we had fabulous numbers. You're a big draw. You're fabulous.
Oh,
fabulous
yeah,
numbers.
Yeah, I'm a big hitter.
That's great stuff. Andy, I've been pursuing this issue that Biden should be out there protecting the Supreme Court justices now that this crazy group has revealed their addresses. And this will lead to no good. Madam Psaki says they're not concerned, you know, there's going to be nonviolent protests. People are passionate. They're not concerned about the leak. They're not concerned about now that these addresses are out there and there are going to be protests. And I guess one question I had that you might know, is it the U.S. Marshals Service that protects the Supreme Court justices or federal judges? Have they done anything extra to increase protection? And somebody told me, last question, Andy, somebody told me that actually it's against the law to protest at their homes or some such thing. Maybe you can clear that up for us.
So, Larry, the Supreme Court has its own police force for purposes of security at their facility, the Supreme Court courthouse, as well as the security of the justices. And they're the ones who have actually taken over the leak investigation, which is one of the reasons I don't have a lot of hope for it, because they're very good at what they do in terms of security, but they really don't do criminal investigations. Generally, the U.S. Marshals do have jurisdiction over security of the courthouses, but because the judiciary is a separate branch from the executive, obviously, the court has to have its own facilities as well. And I don't begrudge them their facilities. It's just criminal investigation isn't what they do. And just like a sort of a very basic thing, one of the first things forensically you would want to do in an investigation like this is figure out what printer the hard copy of this opinion came off, the draft opinion. That's the kind of thing you really need help from the FBI's lab from. You know, the Supreme Court guys don't have the capacity to do that kind of forensic education. So investigation. So like for a million good reasons, I think they need help from the Justice Department. And I do agree with you that, you know, to my mind, even worse than the leak, and I wouldn't have thought when the leak happened that I'd be talking by the end of the week of something worse than the leak happening to the Supreme Court. But you're absolutely right that the government has to speak as one voice, the executive branch as well as the Congress, that the most important thing here is the Supreme Court as an institution and the safety of the justices. That's like paramount. And the thought that they are subordinating that to something that isn't even an opinion yet. It's not even a ruling of the court. It's a draft. And they are you know, trying to make hay with that politically at the expense of the safety of the justices and the court's viability as an institution is just stunning to me. It's awful. And the final thing, the last thing you asked me, it's obstruction of justice to do corrupt things to try to intimidate or influence a tribunal. And what obviously this is all about is trying to intimidate the justices into changing their opinion. So to me, this is a classic obstruction of justice. And I think everything that they do in the way of trying to influence the justices is exactly that.
Well, Andy McCarthy, now that this crazy group, Ruth Sent Us, has published the home addresses of Roberts, but also Amy Coney Barrett, Alito, Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch. I mean, to me, this is like unleashing a war against the court. When Psaki was asked about this, she didn't have anything to say. She had no opposition to it. She says, well, this is a passionate issue, blah, blah, blah. You know, we saw last summer and two summers ago, you know, groups coming after. I believe he was a judge outside of St. Louis. They walked on his property. It turned violent. And I'm waiting. Why hasn't the White House announced special security measures for the Supreme Court justices?
They absolutely should. You know, Larry, we talk all the time in connection with the Capitol riot about the people who assaulted police and broke into the building and broke windows and all that stuff. And I don't think any of us thinks that those people shouldn't be prosecuted. But they've scorched the earth to prosecute hundreds of people who didn't do anything other than walk through the grounds. And nobody dared, when they indicted all those people, nobody dared come out and say, well, you know, there was a lot of passion that day. There was a lot of passion. People had very passionate feelings. The reaction of the Biden White House was, we're going to prosecute every single one of these people that we can identify. And now the same people are signaling to the crazy left that it's perfectly fine to go to the home of Supreme Court justices and intimidate them over again a draft opinion from 3 months ago that isn't even a ruling of the court.
Who should be sent in to protect?
The marshals should be protecting. The local police should be protecting the homes of the Supreme Court justices. But the most important thing here, Larry, would be the White House has to come out and set the tenor. You know, there's a lot of criticism, and I thought it was rightful, of President Trump for not using the influence he might have had with the people who were rioting at the Capitol. Where is the administration now? They're fomenting this. They're not trying to strike a chord where you say, you know, look, we can disagree with the ruling if that day ever comes, if the ruling gets issued as a ruling. But the Supreme Court justices are off limits. But, you know, the Supreme Court, people shouldn't be demonstrating outside the Supreme Court. Forget about the homes of the justices. And This is exactly why Roe is such terrible law. I mean, you know, the idea is we're supposed to insulate the Supreme Court from political pressure and let them decide cases along the lines of the law. And if something isn't in the Constitution, then it just goes back to the state legislatures and they can regulate abortion. Mm-hmm. They can allow it. And, you know, with restrictions that most people actually support in this country. But, you know, we're in a situation here where there's a real danger to the lives of these justices. And instead of doing everything they can to tamp it down, the White House is just fanning the flames.
Last one, Andrew McCarthy, I want to play you a very quick tape from the third presidential debate in 2016 between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on the subject of late-term abortions. Let's listen to this.
Trump, your reaction, and particularly on this issue of late-term partial birth
abortion. Well, I think it's terrible. If you go with what Hillary is saying, in the ninth month, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb of the mother just prior to the birth of the baby. Now, you can say that that's okay, and Hillary can say that that's okay, but it's not okay with me. Because based on what she's saying and based on where she's going and where she's been, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the ninth month on the final day. And that's not acceptable.
You know, I just play it. I don't want to put you on the spot, but we're one of the few countries, along with North Korea and China, Andy McCarthy, that permits this kind of late-term abortion. We're one of the few left. It's not good.
Yep.
It can't be good.
No, it's not good, Larry. And, you know, part of the reason that that's the case is there's not enough people who do what President Trump did in that clip. You know, a lot of times we talk around this, we have euphemisms, the way we talk about this, you know, I'm pro-choice, it's about choice. And what this is about is what Donald Trump described in that clip. And not enough people are willing to hold up the mirror to the country about what a horror this is. What, not just what a moral travesty it is, but what a physical horror it is. Mm. And I think maybe if we were more courageous in talking about it, we wouldn't be in that, you know, disgraceful rung of countries that allow this right up to the moment of birth.
100%. God bless you. Andrew McCarthy, former district U.S. attorney and National Review and Fox News. Can't thank you enough, Andy. We'll talk soon. Folks, I'm Larry Kudlow. On the other side of the break, we're going to go back to the inflation question with Professor Steve Hanke of Johns Hopkins. I'm Kudlow. Please stick around.
With crime running rampant in New York, you need to keep yourself and your family safe. Obtaining your concealed carry firearm licenses can be difficult and time-consuming. That's where MyFirstPistol.com comes in. They'll help you secure your concealed carry license. If you're looking for a pistol, premise, rifle, or shotgun license, call 347-559-7052. 347-559-7052. You must have a valid firearm license issued by the NYPD to purchase, possess, or shoot a handgun or pistol in NYC. Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I want to turn to the inflation problem, and it is still a big problem. Despite Jay Powell's, Fed Chairman Jay Powell's attempts to kind of whitewash it this past week. I mean, he really sort of blaming it on Putin and supply shortages and, everything but the Fed. And so I bring in my friend Steve Hanke, professor of economics at Johns Hopkins University, an old friend. So, Steve, welcome. I'm looking at your piece, The Fed Looks for Inflation in All the Wrong Places, from the National Review. That's a play on, right? You're looking for love in all the wrong places. They're looking for inflation in all the wrong places. It's pretty clever. I don't think you wrote the header. You wrote the article. They write the header.
No, they have given me the right to write my own headers, Larry.
Well, that's pretty good, actually. It's very unusual. And, you know, and you say, economists quoted in the Wall Street Journal continue to blame non-monetary factors. The war in Ukraine, relative prices elsewhere in the economy is the primary cause of inflation. Yes. So you wouldn't have – I mean, price increases are widespread across the board every place. You wouldn't have, you know, supply chain. If chip prices go up, that doesn't mean the entire price index has to go up. That can only occur if there's too much money chasing too few goods. I think you would agree. So tell us about the threat. Are we making any headway on it or not?
Well, we're not. Let me make a couple of points that you're getting very close to the bullseye as usual. Look, if you look at the Chairman Powell trying to, you know, cover his tracks and so forth, this is an old game with the White House and the Fed trying to cover their tracks. And as you remember, many years ago when you were a student at the University of Rochester, one of your professors was a famous Carl Bruner, one of the greatest monetary economists in history.
Yep.
And Bruner gave a speech. He was, remember, not only a famous professor of economics, but he was also the co-director of the Shadow Open Market Committee with Alan Meltzer, another great economist. And Bruner gave a speech in Caracas in February of 1982, in which he laid out why the Fed had a big disinformation machine to confuse the public about inflation. Whenever inflation rose its ugly head, as Bruner and you and I know, it's all because the money pump gets turned on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's excess money being created, as you said, too much money chasing too few goods. So the result of that, which you probably don't know, Larry, is that Bruner actually was, after that speech, prohibited from entering Federal Reserve headquarters in Washington, D.C. The security guard literally had orders.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So, Carl Bruner, nice old Carl Bruner. My goodness. That's pathetic.
Yeah. So at any rate, that is one aspect of this looking in all the wrong places with all these excuses and everything else. The second thing, Larry, is kind of a theoretical thing, and that is the models that young people learn now are these post-Keynesian macroeconomic models, and those models don't include money. So they don't include the money pump. The third factor that is slightly related to the first factor of covering their tracks is a political bias in the Federal Reserve System. The Fed has 785 economists employed in the whole system. None of them got this thing right, Larry. None of them anticipated any of this.
Right.
416 of them are employed in Washington at headquarters. Out of those, the ratio of Democrats to Republicans is 48.5 to 1. So the Democrats completely dominate the scene. Now you say, well, you know, you're getting into conspiracy theory, Hanky. No, I'm not, because we all know that one of the great enemies of and threats to the Democrats is always Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman is synonymous with monetarism. So M equals M. Monetarism equals Milton Friedman. And the Dems want to keep Milton and any of his ideas buried very deep. So this is one reason why Chairman Powell has literally testified before Congress in February of last year, in front of Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, he articulated very clearly, the chairman did, that we must unlearn monetarism,
right. That
the money supply does not have any effect on economic activity, and it's something that the Fed doesn't even look at. So that's the nub of what's going on. Now, to disprove this, by the way, that these factors, the commodity prices and gas prices are causing inflation, the wage growth and tight labor markets are causing it, Putin and Russia are causing it, supply chain bottlenecks and all this other stuff. Just consider the following. The inflation rate in the United States is 8.5%. The inflation rate in Europe is 7.4%. Canada, it's 6.7%. UK, it's 7%.
Mm.
But in Japan, which has had all these same problems that we've had,
the inflation rate is 1.2%. China has had all these problems, maybe even more problems than we've had, and the inflation is 1.5%. Switzerland has had all these problems, supply chain and you name it, oil prices, Putin and all the rest of it. It's 2.4%. So you ask why? And why? All you have to do is look at the money supply growth numbers. The money pump has not been on full speed in Japan, China, and Switzerland, and it has been in every place else.
All right. So basically, though, you're saying that the money supply, the money pump, as you put it, I like that word, is still pumping, right? They've not stopped it, and therefore there's really no reason to think inflation's coming down. That's the bottom line. I've just got two minutes.
It's not quite the bottom line. It is very important, Larry. Let's assume they bring the pump down today and they're able to do that immediately. Then what happens? We have a lot of monetary overhang or excess money in the monetary bathtub that they've pumped in there that will keep coming out. So even if they are able to get it down to the right level, we will have inflation of 6% or more for the next 2 years because of all this excess that's in the system. And to give you an indication of what the excess is, Larry, the banks are engaged in what they call reverse repos.
Yeah.
It's a technical thing, but this is they're loaning money to the Fed. They have so much liquidity.
I got to go.
$1.8 trillion, 20% of the Fed's assets.
My buddy Steve Hanke. No, it's a good point. Excess money reigns, and we're going to have an inflation problem for the next couple of years. I'm Kudlow. We're going to talk to Steve Forbes about inflation right after this. Please stick around.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to talk to Steve Forbes, chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes Media, and his new book, Inflation, What It Is, Why It's Bad, and How to Fix It, is out. It's a great book. I read it. And, Steve, it's great to have you. I want to talk to you about inflation and jobs, but I just got to read you this. I just saw this on the Fox Business website. They seized Putin's yacht, his $700 million super yacht. Yes. I have been ragging on this for weeks on the air. Putin's alleged $700 million super yacht seized in Italy. Italians, I love this. They scrambled to investigate. They say it's nearly 460-foot super yacht known as, I can never pronounce this word, Scheherazade. I don't know, it's a biblical word. Anyway, dry docked in the Tuscan port of Marina del Carrara, concerns mounted. The Kremlin-linked vessel was set out to Italian waters shortly. They nailed it. I wanted the U.S. to nail it in conjunction with it, but I don't care. They took his yacht. I love this.
Well, that's right. And what they should do is put it up for auction and use the proceeds to provide arms to Ukraine.
Yes.
And give Ukraine all the weapons it needs to win that war. We're still not doing it, shockingly, which obviously has an effect on the economy. And Ukraine now, from their experience of fighting the Russians since 2014 in eastern Ukraine, and the training they received from NATO that nobody knew about, they have one of the two or three best armies in the world today. So give them the means to do the job.
Great points all across the board. Important, really important points. So let me ask you this, Steve Forbes. So here's this guy, Putin. He's been president and prime minister and whatever, 30, 40 years. He's a public official. How does he afford a $700 million super yacht? And I'm going to go back. I sang this on the air a couple of weeks ago of our Fox Business show from the great Broadway play Fiorello. People of a certain age listening to this will remember Fiorello, where they're trying to get rid of the corrupt mayor who also had a yacht, and they launch into this famous song, You know, how did you afford this? Well, I gave up smoking for a couple of months, and I put my pennies into a little tin cup. And so Putin put into a little – and it's a famous song called – you know, if I had known this was coming out, I have the song in my folder at home, The Little Tin Cup. But really, Putin's a – look.
Well, that is so right, and you know what 401k advice I want to know. The inquiring public wants to know.
Yes.
Who manages his money?
Well, the point, in all seriousness, the point I kept trying to make, and I wanted Biden and his people to make this point. He is a war criminal, no question about that. But he is also, Steve, a crook, been stealing hundreds of billions of dollars from the Russian working people for decades. He's just a big crook, and I don't know why they didn't launch that narrative.
It's a criminal enterprise.
Right.
And if you don't cooperate, as some of these oligarchs have sadly discovered, suddenly you get these strange diseases, you disappear, your family disappears. It's a criminal enterprise. And why we don't hammer that home on Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, why we don't hammer that home by our own State Department. And the word will seep through that at the same time they're sending tens of thousands of Russian conscripts who don't know how to fight to early deaths in Ukraine, these guys are still looting the country. Hmm. And that's why the military stinks there, is because the generals and the defense people were all on the take, and it infected, rotted the army. The non-coms are on the take. I mean, they loot these towns in Ukraine, and then they've put it in cars they've stolen and sell the stuff in Russia. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
Ryan, I'm going to go to Ryan, my crackerjack producer, researcher. Go Google up Fiorello, all right? It's called Little Tin – I think the Little Tin Cup is the name of the song. And we'll play it at some point. If you don't find it during Steve Ford, we'll play it later. But I'll bet you're going to find it. It was kind of like the lead song in that great Broadway play, which I think was in the early 60s, but I'm not sure. Anyway, Steve, yes. Forbes, you're spot on. I mean, so how does it – I wasn't going to ask you about this, but let's talk about Ukraine. How does it look to you right now that – you know, Ukrainians are always doing better than anybody felt, you know, believes possible. How does this story look to you?
Well, the story right now is that I think Putin's recognized, obviously, didn't get that quick victory. And the question now is he serious about all this talk about using nukes? They have more than any other country in the world, these low-grade tactical nukes that are one-third of the blasting power of what we dropped in Hiroshima in 1945. And the question is, would he really do a demonstration or even bomb a city in Ukraine and say, you give me what I want, or we're going all the way? And I think the way I hope right now Washington is taking that seriously and behind the scenes credibly saying, here are the consequences if you even get close to that. They also know you have to go through a chain of command to do that kind of thing. Are we contacting Russian officers? Are we making clear you're going to be tried as war criminals if you survive this thing? So I hope they're laying down those markers. And then the question becomes, what does Putin do on Monday when he makes the celebration of the Allied victory, Russian victory against the Nazis in World War II? What is he going to outline there as a so-called victory? That's why he's so desperate to get that port city of Mariupol, because he has nothing else to show for it. And so he's reduced the city to rubble, and he's going to try to make that a great victory. But we have to drive Putin out of Ukraine and make very clear you don't even consider using nukes, because the consequences, you not only is your whole economy going to be shut down, your Black Sea is going to be blockaded, all the money is going to be seized, and your ships are going to be sunk. Then we got to credibly make that clear. Don't even go near that, because you cross that threshold and other countries are going to be doing it. It's just a disaster, human disaster.
Well, agreed on all sense. All right. We actually have this is the Putin 401k song. Go ahead, folks.
Your witness,
Mr. X, may we ask you a question? It's amazing, is it not? that the city pays you slightly less than $50 a week, yet you've purchased a private yacht.
I am positive, Your Honor, must be joking. Any working man can do what I have done. For a month or two, I simply gave up smoking, and I put my extra pennies one by one
into a little tin box. A little tin box
that a little tin key unlocks.
Oh, it's fabulous.
There is nothing unorthodox about a little tin box.
All right, kids. That's just great stuff. So there's your 401k management. it's a very serious subject, but, I mean, you got to have a little bit of fun on a Saturday morning. Steve Forbes, yeah. Nobody's as good as you are. Let's take a quick break, Steve, and then we'll come back and talk about inflation and the jobs report. But I do appreciate your analysis. This tactical nuclear weapons threat is a very, very serious business. You're quite right on that. We're talking to Steve Forbes of Forbes Media. He needs no introduction from me or anybody else. We will come back with Steve Forbes after this brief word.
Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're talking to the great Steve Forbes, chairman and editor-in-chief Forbes Media, and really must read his new book, Inflation, What It Is, Why It's Bad, and How to Fix It. Steve Forbes, what'd you make of the jobs numbers yesterday? And, of course, worker wages, average hourly earnings, I'll use the one for production workers, up 6.4%. Last 12 months, which is a good number, but unfortunately, it's 2 percentage points underneath the inflation rate. So real wages are still falling. But there's some people on Wall Street are saying a little bit of weakness in the job numbers. Looks like inflation is coming down. What are you thinking?
Well, I think the jobs report was fairly good. But the one thing that two things raise red flags. One is, people are dropping again out of the labor force, especially people who haven't had completed high school education and the like. What is going on there? The other thing that is a first sign that there may be trouble brewing is as you know, Larry, they have two surveys. One gets the publicity, but they also have the household survey. That survey, which usually captures small businesses better, but so their job numbers are all over the map. But over time, they match the number that we get reported each month. That job number actually went down 323,000, which I think shows trouble on the small business front, both trying to hire people, but also that they're facing real pressures that are going to affect the economy. So overall, good report, but there are red flags there. And on the inflation front, the Federal Reserve is still dragging its feet. You know, we point out there are two kinds of inflation, monetary and non-monetary. This government's making the non-monetary worse. Now they're going after railroads, which is going to raise costs, artificially raise costs. But on the money front, the Fed does have this massive amount of money. Steve Hanke, your previous guest, made reference to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now over $1.8 trillion that is ready to flood the economy. And one thing that got no publicity is the Federal Reserve raised the rate it pays on bank reserves parked at the Federal Reserve. It's now 0.9%.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they're going to be trying gimmicks to try to prevent a flood of money coming into the economy. But as people run down their cash, interest rates go up. I think you'll see more bank lending, more credit card lending, and that's how you get traditional money creation. And the best battle, the way you battle this, in addition to stop the money printing and start reducing the money supply, is go to some sort of gold standard, whether it was the informal one that Greenspan had for part of the 1990s or what we had under Bretton Woods. But we did an article the other day, my two co-authors, Nathan Lewis and Elizabeth Ames for Fox Business Opinion, that you can't even discuss such a thing anymore. Even though Greenspan informally used it, it's cancel culture. You can't even bring that up anymore. So the Fed, as you well know, the only way they know how to fight inflation is by slowing the economy. Even though they say the Phillips curve is out the window, they're still practicing it. They got to slow the economy to fight inflation, and that is just the wrong cure.
You know,
the dollar stable again. King dollars, you used to say.
No, that's right. Listen, go back. You mentioned Greenspan. You can go back a little further. Ronald Reagan appointed, remember, Steve, Wayne Angel, Manley Johnson, and Robert Heller, three Reagan appointees to the Federal Reserve Board in 1985 and 1986. And those guys generated a discipline. I think that Wayne Angel was best known for it, but the others, whether you looked at a commodity price rule or Manley Johnson and the late Bob Heller, Bob Kelleher, I beg your pardon, wrote a book about market price signals. But basically, you'd be using gold, commodity indexes, the yield curve, and the exchange rate. And when they got out of line, like in an inflationary environment, the exchange rate would go down, gold commodities would go up, the yield curve would widen. That was a signal to the Fed to tighten up their balance sheet, which in those days we called the monetary base. It still is the monetary base.
Right.
Just don't use that phrase. And that's,
yes, it's amazing.
But that's really what you're driving at. Is that kind of it?
Yes.
You don't want to.
Yes, because the one thing the Fed can control is the monetary base.
Right.
They can't control velocity or anything else.
That's right.
But they can control the monetary base. And I'm afraid now they still think they can bottle up these excess reserve money they've created by those reverse repos. In effect, they borrow the money back every night. So they create the money and then they borrow it back. Really smart. And by hiking the interest rate, they pay on reserves to try to keep banks from lending. But it's ultimately not going to work. So get your act together, guys. And whether you do a clean gold standard or a partial one, like we did have in the 80s and the part of the 90s, you don't have to artificially depress the economy. We have enough trouble without the Federal Reserve pushing us over a cliff.
You know, I thought listening and watching and reading Jay Powell, Fed Chairman Jay Powell, I mean, I really thought he sounded like Biden because he's, you know, he's blaming it on Putin, a.k.a. the Ukrainian war, and what he called pandemic, blah, 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 supply shortages. But that stuff, first of all, the oil price surge started way before Putin because they've run a jihad against fossil fuels and the Green New Deal crazies in the White House. But you wouldn't have oil prices rising. These indexes, flawed as they may be, would not all be rising. Some individual prices go up, some individual prices go down. That's the supply shortage point. But you've got – which because you have excess money – you've got all these prices going up. And commodities may have topped off briefly, but they're still at a very high level. And on the exchange rate with King Dollar, as Hanke was saying, almost all these other currencies have been inflating almost as badly as we have. Not all of them.
And that's why the dollar looks strong on the foreign exchange.
That's,
you know, the
right.
dollar index is over 100.
Right.
And that's not because we're doing a great job. It's everyone else is doing a worse job.
I mean, I'd like to see gold drop $1,000 or $2,000, and I'd like to see the commodity indexes drop, 15-20%. That would tell me the Fed has stopped printing excess money, but I'm not seeing that.
No, and unfortunately, the Fed is floundering. I like to compare it to what they're doing to what the doctors used to do in days of old when they bleed the patient to cure the patient.
Hmm.
That got rid of the pain and suffering because it got rid of the patient. And the Federal Reserve is doing the same thing today. They don't realize if the real core essence of inflation, other than the non-monetary kind, when you shut economies down and you get droughts or stuff like that, is when you reduce the value of your currency, the intrinsic, the base value of your currency. And you make your currency weaker. By golly, you're going to have trouble. And what these people don't understand, you can get regulations right, you can get spending right, you can get taxes right. But if the money's not right, you have problems. And these people who say, oh, we need 2-4% inflation, name one country in history that achieved great wealth and did great things with unsound money. Just doesn't happen, period.
Steve Forbes, go back. You were making a point. And I read this briefly, but I haven't really covered it on the
on the Fox Business Show. The Bidens are going after railroads now.
That's right. One thing President Jimmy Carter did right, and Democrats like Ted Kennedy and with Republican support, of course, is that in the late 70s and early 80s, they deregulated all the transportation. They deregulated trains, planes, trucks. And as a result, the railroad industry at the time, which was going all the companies are going bankrupt, went from insolvency to the greatest freight rail system in the world. The track is up to date. The technology is fantastic. No country comes close to matching it either in Europe, Japan, or China. Now this administration's decided because we have fewer railroads today than we did 40 years ago, they have to create artificial competition by forcing railroads to give money to smaller railroads when they carry freight. So in effect, they're want a sort of income redistribution. Well, you do that kind of nonsense, what's going to happen to investment? Rails are very, very capital intensive. And if you start forcing these companies not to make the investments they need, we're going to go back to where we were in the terrible late 1970s. Mm. So they're going after railroads. As you know, they reinstated the crazy rules that Trump tried to push back. So infrastructure projects are now going to take longer.
Yeah, the NEPA.
Do more studies and stuff like that.
The NEPA rules.
Everything they can do to gum up the economy, they're doing. And now they want to force banks to make loans to low-income communities. Fine to make the loans, but when you have the government involved, you get the loans that shouldn't be made. Let the economy alone, but they just do the exact opposite.
We were talking to Steve Scalise, Republican House Leader Steve Scalise, about the diesel fuel, Steve Forbes, and the trucking industry. So diesel fuel is like $5.50, $6 now, and that's killing the trucking industry. The trucking industry is responsible for almost 3/4 of the goods shipments inside the U.S. So there's another killer because of the Green New Deal and the war against fossil fuels.
Yeah, when you look at the requirements refineries have in terms of what they're allowed to refine, not to mention building a new refinery, good luck with that. Even LNG plants, which we would think we would want to put on a fast track to help Europe out vis-a-vis Russian gas, they're dragging their feet on that. The federal leasing, yeah, the courts say they can't block it, but they find other ways to block it through regulation. And railroads too use diesel for crying, you know. So
that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So it hits everything, and so they're putting up these artificial barriers, and then complaining about the fact that costs go up. The Federal Reserve still doesn't realize that they got things semi right in the late 1980s and part of the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Not to mention what we did before in the 50s and 60s. Let me just give you one statistic, by the way. On when we had the old Bretton Woods gold standard from the late 1940s to around 1969, 1970, the average growth rate of the American economy was 4.2%. Since then, before COVID distortion, let's leave out COVID, it was 2.7. You compound that over 50 years. If we had maintained anywhere near that average historic growth rate, you know, the household income median, which is now, what, $67,000, would be about $100,000 to $110,000 today. Wouldn't people be happier with $30,000, $40,000 more income? That's what happens when they fool around with their money and we have a pauper dollar instead of king dollar.
And you know what? So if you had king dollar, price stability, minimal taxes, minimal regulations, you could grow the economy at 3.5% to 4% in the long run. People have forgotten. They've given up on that.
No way.
Right.
We could easily grow 4%.
All right. We'll
3.5%, 4%.
The great Steve Forbes. Steve, can't thank you enough. And we'll send you a copy of Fiorello, the little tin box. I'm Larry Kudlow, folks. We're going to take a break. We may play Fiorello, little tin box in Putin's honor. Putin lost his yacht, finally. And we're going to look at the stock market. Please stick around. Much more work to do today. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Please join us during the week. Fox Business. Name the show's Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. You can join us if you can't make it. You can DVR us. Call up your favorite 9-year-old and show you how to DVR the show. Anyway, we are here to talk about the stock market. 6 straight weekly decline. That was off 335 points. But that doesn't really tell you how much fun we had. Up 900, down 1,000. I mean, pretty wild stuff. We had the jobs report, which was okay. Inflation, not okay. Jay Powell and the Fed, not okay. But I'm getting ahead of the story. I don't want to get too far ahead of the story. We've got Michelle Girard, Managing Director and Co-Head of Global Economics at NatWest Markets, and David Kotok, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer at Cumberland Advisors. David Kotok, it's been quite a while since we've talked.
Yes, Larry. I think McKinley was president when we first met.
You could be right. I was thinking more Grover Cleveland, who happens to be one of my favorite presidents because he kept the dollar pegged to gold. But Michelle is way too young to remember all that stuff.
But David, it's so nice to speak to you. It's been a while for us, too. So great to be on with you today.
All right. So, Michelle.
Yes, thanks so much. It's like a reunion of many years. And yes. Here we are, like Jack Benny, we're only 39 years old.
Yes, there you go.
So, Michelle, you're going to be nicer because you're a much nicer person than I am, particularly when it comes to the Fed. But I'm just going to say that I was underwhelmed by Jay Powell. I thought they're back to their old tricks. I mean, Steve Hanke said it earlier on the show. Steve Forbes mentioned it. You know, everyone's to blame for the inflation but the Fed. Right? That's the deal. Putin, the Ukrainian war, COVID, the woman on the moon. Everybody's to blame but the Fed. So I want to get your Fed take. Are you convinced now the Fed is on top of it? And I'm getting a lot of whispers, Wall Street whispers, that we've seen the worst of inflation and it's going to come back down. You buy it?
Well, there's a lot of things in that to unpack. I mean, I would say that I was curious about the decision that Powell made to take 75 basis points off the table.
Right.
Because I think in general he was trying to send a strong and, if you will, hawkish message that the Fed was committed to bringing inflation down. And we can talk about whether it's demand or supply related. As you said, they seem to focus very much on supply, supply problems, which then opens them up to criticism because everyone says, well, then what is the Fed doing because they can't control, you know, the supply problems. And so there's all we can get into that. But he was trying to send a message. He was hearkening back to Volcker, you know, we'll do what's necessary, even if it means we risk recession. And then he turns around and acknowledging the uncertainty, but still says, but, you know, 75 is not something we're thinking about. And I don't know why he, you know, he kind of sort of needed to do that. I will say with respect to inflation, the Fed is going to have a little bit of help here because on a year over year basis, the numbers are going to start to come down. You know, we're going to see this next week. We have the CPI coming out. We've seen a little bit of relief on the energy or, you know, some relief that we saw in May on the energy front will come through. So but the statistics, because we had such high numbers last year, are going to look like year over year we're moving in the right direction. So that may buy him some time. I just look worried about looking ahead. And in 2023 or later this year, if you settle out and as good as you get is maybe, you know, somewhere just under 4, like what do you do then? You know, when that benefit of the year over year numbers is not working in your favor, it's not as, you know, and you have to admit you're still not comfortable. You're still not as, you know, low as you want it to be, then what are you going to do? And so that, I think, is going to be the problem they face down the road.
You're still going to have monthly readings, though. I mean, I know the year-over-year basing stuff, but that's kind of, you know, statistical chicanery. I mean, really.
No, you're 100% right. Although, again, optically for the public, you know, which I think kind of looks at those annual inflation rates, it will take a little bit of pressure off. So it's a pure optics play. I don't really see you're going to get much improvement on the underlying rate of inflation. And that's why, you know, I believe once those optics sort of wash out, the Fed is going to be left having to acknowledge that the inflation rate is not where they want it to be.
Yeah. And David Kotuck, we had Steve Hanke on earlier. He's a well-known monetarist, very smart guy. He said that basically, in his view, the basic inflation rate was going to be 6% for a couple of years. And I think that if that is the case, or nearly the case, I mean, it's not 10, but it's not 2 either, which is their ultimate target, or so they say. 6% inflation is rough stuff, and that's going to force them into doing things much more aggressively. And brings, I think, you know, you go from inflation to stagflation to recession. I mean, what are the chances that you have that kind of difficult scenario?
Well, we have an aggregate demand shock, Larry. We have an aggregate supply shock. That's a double whammy that comes right on the heels of a similar 2-year-ago pandemic double whammy back to back. I was just sitting listening, thinking about the fact you and I met each other before you went to work for Ronald Reagan. And we were talking then about the late 70s, the very beginning of Volcker, the inflation characteristics that we will admit to viewers, or at least I will, that's how long we know each other.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the 70s. This is not an Arthur Burns easing Fed. This is a dual whammy. A pandemic comes along once in 100 years, and it's a shock of huge proportion. There's a great study done on that by the San Francisco Fed in a working paper in 2020 where they examined the economic shocks of pandemics, and they parallel wars. Similar, Spanish flu, World War One. So we're in a different construction than we're used to. And now we have the shooting war. So I'm not so sure we're going to get to 6, 8, 9% perpetual inflation. I think we could get some rollover. And I was flashing back in memory. I remember conversations with Michelle about housing rolling over, worrying about mortgages. You know, look at where we are now. We're above 5% on a 30-year mortgage. Suddenly the housing bubble may have a pin stuck into it. In fact, it's a conversation that could cause rollover of this inflation scare. Used car prices starting to roll over. There's possibilities it won't be as big as the warning that we get from the inflationists.
What are the chances? Well, let's take a break. We got to take a break. We'll come back and talk about the potential for stagflation or the potential for recession, and then how high are interest rates going to go? The 10-year broke 3% this week. It looks like it's up there permanently. We can talk about that. And how high is the Fed's target rate going to have to go? Anyway, we're talking to David Kotuck of Cumberland Advisors, Michelle Girard of NatWest Markets, and I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I'm here talking stocks and the economy with Michelle Girard, Managing Director, Co-Head Global Economics, NatWest Markets, and David Kotuck, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Cumberland Advisors. Michelle, a couple things. There's a lot of talk about recession. Let's start with that. Do you see any recession?
I think the risks have gone up. I would say they're you know, normally I think you always say there's, you know, 20% or something. I mean, I think they're higher than that. It isn't our base case, but I am watchful of it. Not so much this year as next year. And again, I just think it's we do think inflation will be more persistent. I do think the Fed is going to have to raise rates more than people think. I don't think it's going to be a straight line. I think, you know, they'll move, they'll pause, they'll have to start, you know, start again. I think right now the economy does have some underlying resilience. I think the consumer still continues to be weathering the impact of higher food and energy prices in particular, well. But I think we're going to lose momentum because the Fed is going to have to I fear, having waited so long, the only way that the Fed will be able to get inflation down to toward the 2% mark is to orchestrate, you know, a much sharper turn down in demand.
So the 2-year CPI break-evens, the TIPS break-evens, closed at 4.15. So, yep. Michelle, fell 21 basis points, but it's 4.15. So that would suggest if the Fed's going to conquer inflation, we're going to need a Fed funds rate in the next 2 years that would be, above 4.15. Call it 5, I don't care, whatever you want to call it. That's not on anybody's radar screen.
No, it isn't. At the moment, the market is pricing at a peak Fed funds rate of right around 3.25% in the, the second quarter of next year. And so they do, there is an expectation policy will move restrictive, but ultimately that's, I think that isn't likely to probably be sufficient and given the expectations that we have as I said, inflation settling out this year, core inflation settling out this year, finishing this year around 4%. And at the end of next year, even with the funds rate getting up to that level, we have inflation ending the year at 3%. So I just think the Fed is going to end up having to do more. But again, I don't think it'll be a one-way line. I actually think in the near term, markets are going to get more concerned about this growth story, about a growth slowdown, and the Fed may well, end up having to pause at some point and then restart. It won't be a straight line. But I just don't think when you look at the end state that I think people's expectations about what will probably be needed are too low.
David Kotak, how does a stock market investor play this?
You have to see the earnings. We're seeing them. And then it seems to me, Larry, you have to believe that the earnings growth rates will continue. And that's now in doubt for reasons Michelle just eloquently explained. My view is the fourth quarter of last year, the S&P 500 index delivered over $55 in earnings for the quarter. The original estimates before that quarter started to report were below 52. And as the earnings were delivered, market agents said, wait a minute, that's more than we expected. This first quarter, which is almost finished reporting, I think we have 80-some% of the companies reported, is doing it again. We're probably 55, 56 S&P 500 earnings for the first quarter, and no one expected it. We have the earnings growth rate continuing. We see the profit share. Now, there was a big threat long ago, you talked about it, others talked about it, that we would have higher corporate taxes, we would raise the corporate tax rate. All those approaches in politics are non-starters. And so we pencil out an earnings trajectory that will continue to grow. And if the earnings trajectory continues to grow, let's say 225 this year, 235 next year, and I'm using mild numbers. And Michelle's trajectory on interest rates is 4. Mine is in the 3s, but terminal rate somewhere around 4. The stock market is a bargain here. Everyone is scared. So when fear is driving the stock price, not the earnings momentum, stocks become very attractive. And we think that's an evolving situation.
What about if you get, the 10-year note finished at 3.12, so it's up 19 basis points this week. If that thing goes to 3.5 or 4, put it in that range, what happens to multiples, David Kotak?
Well, let's use 4. Let's use the higher number.
Yeah.
and say, okay, what's the whole yield curve look like at that point in time? The 10-year is 4. Let's put the short-term rate at 3 or 3.25, a relatively flat curve but no inversion. And then you say, how would I calculate the equity risk premium on that outlook? And you would say, well, okay, I'll take 18, 19 times. That's not so bad.
No.
In a trajectory that is post-double whammy, aggregate supply shock, aggregate demand shock twice in a row in 2 years. That's not a bad picture.
Michelle Gerard, how high the 10-year?
Well, you know, actually, Larry, we think you may be getting close to the top in the sense that it does feel like we keep saying peak hawkishness or concern about the Fed has been priced in. As I said, the market has priced in a lot of Fed tightening already, which is what has pushed us across the curve to get yields up above 3%. There's a high end terminal rate that's already been incorporated. And I do think that these growth concerns are going to mount. So there is, I think, a likelihood that we may actually be kind of near as high as we're going to get for the time being and see some, you know, a little bit like we saw after the meeting on Wednesday, some people willing to begin to buy at these and nibble at these higher attractive levels over 3%, again, as people become concerned about the growth outlook. So our view is actually over the near term, at these levels, it might, you know, you might actually see yields move a bit lower. And then again, perhaps later in the year, see a reversal. I guess the other thing I would mention too, I think is just worth pulling in. I do think if we think about globally the economic situation, I do think the other theme is a return to sort of U.S. exceptionalism. We may have issues, we may have growth concerns, but we are insulated to a much greater degree than the U.K., than Europe, in terms of the threats from the, you know, obviously the Ukraine invasion, in terms of China, which has got, you know, doubling down on its COVID strategy. There's a lot of concern about slower growth in China. You know, Europe and the U.K. are much more vulnerable to those developments. So I do think on a relative basis, while risk assets here may be more challenged, I do think the U.S. is going to continue to look like a relatively attractive place. I think the dollar outlook is positive. I think it's just worth mentioning that as well.
Well, you got to hope the cavalry is coming. I mean, if the cavalry comes, you're both, you know, we're going to be okay. But if these folks, if the Green New Deal wins and high taxes win, now the good part is we saved America and killed the bill. Biden doesn't want to take no for an answer, but he doesn't have the votes to do it. So we're going to take this all the way to the election. So if the cavalry comes, taxes stay low, we won't get the regulatory relief, but I think you got a shot at it. But I think you're both underestimating. I mean, I think Hanke's right. 6% inflation for the next 2 years. Okay? I'm going to give you the last word, David Kotov. 6% inflation for the next 2 years. There you go. Boom.
I'll take the under. The next time we visit together, we'll celebrate history. Both of you, be safe and careful. It's so nice to be back with both of you.
That's great. The cavalry's coming. 6% inflation. All good. Michelle Gerard, thank you. David Kotok, thank you. Stock market investors, good luck, kids. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to talk money and politics right after this with Liz Peek and Steve Moore. Please stick around.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Join us during the week, Fox Business, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. You can live stream us here on the Internet, LarryKudlowShow.com. We're going to talk money and politics with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, Steve Moore, FreedomWorks, and Committee to Unleash Prosperity, and his latest book called GovZilla. Kids, I want to begin with this bulletin. I'm such an Italian government fan now. This is it. Italy has taken Putin's yacht, the Scheherazade. I can never pronounce it. They have taken his yacht. I have been calling for this for weeks. How is Vladimir Putin
How does Vladimir Putin, who's been a public servant, quote unquote, for four decades, own a $700 million yacht? Well, let me refer to people of a certain age will remember this great Broadway hit, Fiorello. Go.
Your witness.
Mr. X, may we ask you a question? It's amazing, is it not, that the city pays you slightly less than 50 bucks a week, yet you've purchased a private yacht?
I am positive, Your Honor, must be joking. Any working man can do what I have done. For a month or two, I simply gave up smoking, and I put my extra pennies one by one
into a little tin box, a little tin box
that a little tin key unlocks.
All right, there you go. This is the best morning I've had in ages. We finally took Putin's yacht, all right, which he stole from the Russian people, and that's not all he stole. He quit smoking for a couple of months and put it all into a little tin box. So, Liz, Peek, number one, I feel vindicated. I wish it had been the United States, but it is not to be. But I'm going to love the Italian government. And he is a crook. He's a war criminal and a crook. He also may be very sick. So what do you think of this story?
Well, it's obviously made your day, Larry, and I think that's great. My view is, yeah, it's terrific that Italy's done this, and other countries have also confiscated the oligarch's possessions. Why haven't we? That's really the question on my mind, because we have seen stories about, oh, Biden talks a big game about we're going to take away their toys and we're going to get really tough on these oligarchs and on Putin, but we haven't done it yet. So, yes, Putin is incredibly corrupt. People in honest ways of life who are politicians don't end up with mega yachts, which this one is. It's really a mega yacht, by the way. And I've always thought the great things about these yachts, whether it was owned by Russians or Chinese or whoever, is that they're kind of floating castles. If things get tough, they can take to sea. They can sell them for, you know, billions of dollars or hundreds of millions anyway. Turns out that's not the case, and bravo to Italy for showing us the way.
Yeah, you know, Steve Moore, I think it's 435 feet. But Steve Forbes makes a good point. They took the yacht, now sell it, and whatever it's worth, $700 million, you know, give the money to the Ukraine to buy weapons. I mean, that's an important strategy.
Yeah, look, I love that story, and it is sad that Italy is now tougher on Russia than the United States of America. That's pathetic. But one of the things that always just irritated me to no end during the Trump presidency was this line by the media that Trump was in the hip pocket of Putin. Remember, I mean, that was their story for 4 years. And look, I've said this many times. I think I said it on your show. I honestly believe that if Trump were still president, Russia would not have invaded Ukraine. But the main point is, why is Biden so weak? I mean, why isn't he taking a stronger position? We can repel with the aid of the NATO allies and the United States taking the lead. We can repel this invasion.
Yes.
But he's scared. He's scared. And I think we see that at every turn of the road. We were hesitant to start sending arms. If we knew early last fall or even by spring that there was a good chance that Putin was going to invade Ukraine, we should have been loading up the weapons into that country so that he would be scared to do it. But it was Biden who was frightened, who's constantly kind of taking one step back because we're afraid of angering Vladimir Putin. Yeah. That is really the truth. And the question is why? Is he really going to launch a nuclear weapon against the West, in which case Russia would be annihilated? Mm. And I cannot see that we are going to constantly let this bully, admittedly a nuclear-armed bully, basically dictate to the West what is going to happen in our futures. I mean, I think it's unconscionable. And unfortunately, we do not have a strong leader at the helm, and boy, do we need one right now.
I mean, I think that's the key point on that. You know, when the 150,000 troops or whatever were amassing on the border of eastern Ukraine,
the Biden diplomacy was to say, if you know, if you go one step further, we're going to do this and this and this, and we're going to impose terrible sanctions. What we should have been doing is, A, we should have put the sanctions on sooner, but B, we should have been reloading them militarily. While those troops were there, we lost months of potential progress and rearming of Ukraine. Turns out we are teaching their troops. I mean, we are training their troops, which is a good thing, and I think we're lending some intelligence. I don't know if the tide is turning, but I just really couldn't resist the little tin box here. I mean, it just brought tears to my eyes. I saw it on the cell phone about an hour ago, and I started going crazy because, well, because you two have been suffering through this with me also. Can I ask another some tricky stuff? Steve Forbes, I'll start with you. In the Pennsylvania Senate primary race between Dr. Oz and David McCormick, a very interesting thing. You surely saw it this morning. President Trump is out there rallying for Oz, but at the same time, Mike Pompeo, this is the interesting part, publicly rallying for McCormick and taking some major league shots at Oz, like, you know, McCormick served in the U.S. military and Oz served in the military, but it was the Turkish military. All right. Now, I've not seen this kind of confrontation between President Trump and any of his former people, for that matter. What do you make of this? I mean, this is Pompeo making a move very visibly, coming out against the president's guy. And this is a bitter primary. It'll be in not this Tuesday, but the following Tuesday.
Yeah, it's a very close race. And I've met both of them. And frankly, I'm kind of neutral on that race, Larry. I mean, I like both of them, actually. I think they both have real skills and talents. And the most important thing, obviously, is Republicans have to pick up that governorship. It's the Senate race, because they also have a governorship as well. I just make one comment about what's going on politically in this race and so many others around the country. Trump is on a roll right now. I mean, the win in Ohio by J.D. Vance, and I'm not a big J.D. Vance fan. I was kind of neutral in that race as well. But he is moving the needle big time in these races. I'm in Nebraska right now, campaigning with a guy named Charles Herbster, and he is going to win that race in Nebraska because Trump came in last week and did a big rally for him. So Trump is a major, major force in these Republican races around the country.
By the way, on that point, before I get to Liz, I just love that Karl Rove writes a column in the Journal, I guess on Thursday, saying Trump didn't really win big in Ohio.
That was the stupidest column I ever saw. I mean, that was ridiculous. That was a total toss-up race until Trump came in. And then he said, he only moved the needle by six points. Well, that was the 6 points that made the difference between winning and losing.
And he had some other way. By the way, Trump, I didn't know this. Trump endorsed Mike Pence's brother in Ohio for Congress, and he won. And then, of course,
I didn't know that.
Yep. And then also another one, Maxie Meyer, who we all love. Max Meyer is on president's staff. He was in the outer Oval Office staff and other places. Maxie won his race. His primary for Congress. But Liz Peek, come to you back. As plain as I can, is Mike Pompeo running for president? And is Mike Pompeo basically saying he's going to run against Trump?
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting development. Mike Pompeo most certainly is running for president. He's been making a lot of public appearances. He's on Twitter constantly. And I think he's a very formidable person. I wish he had run for a state office instead of putting his sights on the Oval Office, because I don't think he's a good presidential candidate. He's got absolutely no warm and fuzzy aspect. He's a brilliant guy, without a doubt, I think. I thought his attack on Oz was very peculiar, because I really don't imagine that Dr. Oz is a Turkish asset, which was kind of the implication, right?
Yes.
I mean, really, that's kind of what he said, was, you know, he's sort of subverting American political position here. For what? For the purpose of enabling Turkish drive to Muslim state? I have no idea really what he's kind of assuming, but it was a hit. And, whether the voters are going to take much notice of that, I don't think so. But I agree with Steve. I think both of the candidates in that race are really credible, and it's too bad, frankly, that they're both running for the same office, because we need good candidates. And, you know, it's too bad we can't spread them around better, you know?
Well, I'm from McCormick, but I don't know anything about the Turkish army. I mean, I'm just, I don't know. I'll have to Google up Turkish army. I'm still into the Italian army. I mean, geez, somebody's going to come out and boost, or maybe it was the Italian Navy. Whatever.
You know, Larry, I think most voters are where you are. They're you know, if Oz had ties to Russia or China, okay, that would be a serious charge. There is no such charge. He has ties to Turkey. Yeah, well, he comes from there. I mean, you know, and he has a Turkish passport, by the way. That, too, I think, was very offensive to Mike Pompeo. I thought this was actually beneath Mike Pompeo, and I'm a little surprised he went there.
Yeah, well,
me too. People don't realize that his last name, because everybody calls him Dr. Oz, but it's Oz, is it Muhammad or something? What's his last name? Muhammad, I think it is. So,
yeah,
I mean, it was kind
like
of
that.
A slur. Yeah.
Yeah, well, look, I happen to be from McCormick, but again.
I think he's a good candidate. I think Oz is too. I've met him. I think he's a very, very smart. I think that the reason that there are some prominent Republicans backing him is, number one, he's got good backing. Number two, he has tremendous following in the black community. There's a feeling that in that race where, you know, Philadelphia voters are obviously going to loom large and other urban centers, that he can do much better with those voters than McCormick. And I think that's maybe true.
I'm going to Google
another big race, by the way, Larry, you know, because Trump has endorsed many gubernatorial candidates. And this is primary season. We've got a bunch of races on Tuesday and in the weeks and months ahead. But the one I don't understand, and I just disagree with Trump on, is in Georgia, where you've got Kemp has been a very good governor. Mm-hmm. He's been a good governor. You know, he's done a lot of stuff. We've rated him very highly. And by the way, Perdue was a fantastic senator. You and I worked with him. Mm-hmm. He was a great senator, and he got caught up in the whole Georgia situation, and it was a real shame that he lost. But Kemp is going to win that race. I'm here to tell you, Kemp is going to win it. Mm-hmm. And Trump said something the other day that really bothered me. He said something like, well, you know, maybe if because he hates Kemp because of the election issue, and that he wouldn't back him on some of these, challenging the election. But he was saying, well, maybe people shouldn't vote for Kemp if he's the nominee. And I'm like, really? Do we really want Stacey Abrams to be the next governor of Georgia?
That was a mistake of 2 years ago when President Trump.
This is kind of a metaphor for where Trump is and where he's going wrong, in my view, right now, is that he cannot move on beyond that 2020 election. And he absolutely has to. And if he torches the governor race in Georgia, he's done. I mean, I think just too many people are going to say, you know what? I'm over him, and I love the agenda. The man has really, unfortunately, ruined his own reputation, and I think if he does that, he will.
Well, I got to take a quick break. While we're in the break, I'm going to Google up Italian Navy. That's the key.
Or Turkish Army. Either one.
I'm afraid to go to the Turkish Army for what I'm going to find. Anyway, Liz Peek, Steve Moore, I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I am here with Liz Peek, Fox Business, Fox contributor and syndicated columnist. Her stuff, I love it. I sort of asked her on the show, Liz, where's your stuff play? She goes all over. She plays all over. But I'm fine with that. I like that a lot. And we have Steve Moore, FreedomWorks, Committee to Unleash Prosperity. His latest book is Godzilla. Kids, the last thing I want to raise is, will the abortion issue, Roe v. Wade, rescue the Democrats in November? Which is going to be more important, Roe v. Wade or inflation, recession, stagflation, and so forth? I'll start with you, Steve Moore.
Well, look, I mean, obviously it is the economy, but this is an issue that I'm very pro-life, as I think I know you are, Larry.
Yep.
But I think Republicans need to figure out how to talk about this issue. I like what you've been saying a lot, Larry, on your show. You know, this is about the children.
Mm-hmm.
It's about babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Republicans have been kind of off message
They keep saying that this isn't going to make abortion illegal, but actually, in many states, it will make abortion illegal. And so that's not a very compelling argument, I think. I think we have to talk about babies, and we have to talk about, you know, alternatives to abortion. And I really defer to Liz because she's a woman, but I'm nervous about it because, you know, the Democrats need a change of topic, and this is what they've been waiting for.
What do you think, Liz?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Democrats have absolutely nothing else they can talk about with any kind of favorable margin or approval. So this is something that energizes their base, to be sure. I'd say I have a couple of thoughts here. One is, because it was leaked, it's a long time till November.
Mm-hmm.
In a funny way, if it had come out at the end of June,
right,
I almost think that would have been a worse problem for Republicans, strictly talking politics now, because Americans' attention span is fairly short, and everyone would have had all that excitement and anger boiling over still in November. I think by November, this is not going to be as top of mind, although there will be candidates raising money on it on both sides. So I'm not quite sure where that shakes out. I think, Larry, the way things are going now is so catastrophic, and I actually really mean that, in terms of markets plunging, bond markets
right,
under pressure, real wages plummeting at the worst rate
right,
in, I don't know, 40 years or something, inflation a real problem. And by the way, I'm looking at a lot of inflation data this morning. There's a lot of reasons to be very pessimistic that price increases are going to moderate anytime soon. I do think that is more compelling come November than Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. That's been, I've asked a lot of people about this, and I've looked at a lot of columns about this, and I haven't really seen a case where Roe v. Wade is going to bail out the Democrats. And, I think the other point, though, I would say to both of you is, look, I respect the choice people. I respect that women's rights and so forth. I always say, what about the rights of the unborn? That's my principal issue. And I do want to save the babies. But Liz, I think we were talking about this on the show. I mean, abortion after the first trimester is increasingly unpopular.
Yeah.
And the Democrats still seem to have this position that was taken by Hillary in the famous exchange with Trump in the debate in 2016. That you should, you know, you go right up to the bitter end, the last day, and you can have late term or partial birth abortion. I mean, I know some states are going to say yes, some states are going to say no. I personally like the idea that the states and the voters will decide, not the judges. But Liz, I just think that, you know, with sonograms and so forth, I don't think many people really want to abort after the first trimester.
I think that's totally right. And most states, basically the laws, and well, polling shows that that's exactly right, that voters are okay with abortion with restrictions. And the restrictions, generally are speaking, have to do with viability outside the womb. And that, though it's changing, certainly, it is usually first trimester. And by the way, that is what almost all developed countries allow. They don't, as someone has been very brilliantly putting up a thing saying 9-month abortion, which is what you can do, by the way, in New York, yes, with some restrictions, but there are ways of getting around those. If you have the right doctor, et cetera, you can have a full-term abortion in New York, which is allowed in, guess where, North Korea and China.
Yep.
So that we are not, I mean, do we really want to align with those countries which have absolutely no regard for human rights of any kind, including the unborn? I don't think so. I think most Americans are repulsed by the idea of someone aborting a third trimester baby, and for good reason. It's a heinous concept. And I mean, what I think will happen is we will have this tremendous battle, and states are going to go to the mat on this. And there are going to be restrictions imposed, some lesser, some more. My guess is there will be legal abortions in most states in that first trimester eventually. And hopefully no states will allow full-term abortions or third trimester. It's a horrible concept.
Steve Moore, in your political travels, are you yet – I know this story just broke a week – or actually on last Monday. Are you encountering – in Republican primaries, for example, any arguments here on Roe v. Wade?
No, not really. Right. I mean, people, Liz is right. I mean, we have a catastrophic economy right now, and people are very afraid, Larry. People are afraid of what's happening in their 401k plans, and they're worried about their jobs. And so that is what people are talking about. I've been on the road a lot lately. I'll just say one more thing about this abortion issue. This is a pro-life country. It really is. Mm-hmm. You know, the support for pro-life has increased over the last 10 or 20 years. And I think that's because of ultrasound and other things were in viability as well. You know, when Roe versus Wade, when was that ruled out? In the early 70s?
73.
Yeah. So, you know, the world's changed a lot in 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know, viability has, you know, started at much earlier periods of pregnancy. So I'll just leave it at that. You know,
63 million.
Let's side with life.
63 yeah. million. And we did some work earlier in the show. We did some research on this. It is African American babies that got hit the hardest by far. Oh,
yep.
African American babies. And that is a tragedy as well. I'm going to leave it there. Liz Peek and Steve Moore, thank you. Everybody, I'm Larry Kudlow. We will be back next weekend. Please watch Fox Business. The name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And we'll be back right here next Saturday.